Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So we're nearly midway through the winter retreat, and Lumpa has asked me to give a few reflections this evening. It's one pra. And the teachings, the readings that he has started on are in the category of exploring the five khandhas, the five aggregates. And that I'd just talk a little bit about that this evening. Kind of just have started on exploring that with some of the definitions of what they are and how to understand their basic structure, the aggregates that we generally tend to refer to as ourselves, forms, feelings, perceptions, volitional formations and consciousness, the aggregates of existence. One of the phrases that strikes me, the Buddha doesn't mince a lot of words in some of his teachings, and I just really appreciate the straightforwardness and directness. It's not always filled with softness and light in the teachings, and there's some pretty bold teachings, and especially in reference to the khandhas as we usually hold them, and one of the phrases that we've heard a few times in the readings, in reference to the any phenomenon that can be experienced as part of the five aggregates should be regarded as a disease, a dart, a tumor or a boil, a calamity. Really strong words, because of the potential for causing suffering when we invest in them, particularly when we imbue them with a sense of ownership, possession, and as a way of seeking satisfaction in the world. So we are admonished to regard it as actually a disease, a dart, a tumor, a disaster. One of the readings that I think will probably be coming up in the next couple of weeks, but I've always appreciated it, and I think I'll just mention a little bit from it this evening, is the teaching in the Samyutta. The title is Yamaka, the name of one of the monks. And I won't go into the whole story, but essentially he is possessed of a wrong view, one that's related to sort of like an annihilationist view. And the monks try to dispossess him of this view and are not successful. And so they turn him over to Sariputta, who does an incredible job of taking him through his wrong view and getting him to see the teaching as it really is taught by the Buddha. But part of that, teaching is when Sariputta offers him a really strong simile that is very powerful. I'll try and paraphrase it anyway. He says, suppose there's a wealthy householder or a wealthy householder's son, and there is a man who has, I guess, something against this wealthy householder, and he wants to murder him. And he's trying to figure out how to do that. So he thinks to himself, well, suppose I become his servant and get to know him and work my way into his life that way. So he approaches the wealthy householder and he offers his services as a servant helper. And the householder accepts that and allows the man to come into his life and get to know him. And over time, through diligence, the servant attends to him and provides him with all he needs and gets to know the householder well, and rises before the householder does, ready there at the ready to greet him in the morning, and stays up until after he's gone to sleep. So he's there, attentive, endearing in his speech and his activities, and gains slowly over time his trust. And at least the way I visualize it is probably more of a 1950s British scene than it is 2,500 years ago, but I see this householder sitting in his easy chair in front of the fire with his pipe, relaxing, not paying much attention to anything, and feeling quite relaxed and at home with his trusty servant. And when he's not paying attention, this servant comes and stabs him in the back and kills him. And the Buddha then, Sariputta then, asks, well, when this servant was initially offering his services, even though the householder didn't know it, was he a murderer then? And the answer is yes. And when he was getting to know him and serving him and setting him up, was he a murderer then? And when he finally did the deed, stabbed him in the back when he wasn't looking, was he a murderer then? The answer is yes, he was. So even though he didn't know it, there was this lurking murderer in his life the whole time, only to be surprised when he wasn't paying attention. So the implication is that this is the five khandhas. We place a lot of trust in them. They're there for us, we think. They serve us well, provide us with a lot of pleasure, form, feelings, perceptions. All can be very pleasant, formations, consciousness. We can have some very delightful experiences, and we become lulled by that pleasure that they provide. And all the while, we're just not paying any attention to the fact that at some point in time, they can and will turn against us. So we're willingly buying into this paradigm that we want to believe. Khandhas are there for us when we go to bed. We enter a dream state, sleep for a while. We wake up, and they're still there, ready to offer us what we want in terms of gratification. So we can see how this kind of operates in our lives. I think everybody knows that. We're all here. We know that the teachings tell us not to put our faith in the aggregates, and particularly the aggregates affected by clinging, the upadana khanda, the five aggregates as affected by clinging. And yet we still do, time after time. We get kind of lulled into our belief that we have some sort of right to expect that they operate the way we want them to operate, that they should do what we want them to do. It's almost like a constitutional right, you know, that in the United States Constitution, we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So we incorporate that into our bodies, into our minds. We think we have the right to pleasant experience, and that it should operate the way we want it to. And then something goes wrong. I mean, just looking around the room, you know, all the knees that are having problems, all the feet and ankles and intestines and different ailments that we're having and have had. It doesn't obey us the way we think it should. And of course, the Buddha did give us this, essentially the four requisites, and one of them is getting medicine for when we're sick, getting treatment for when we're sick. And so we can do that. We have a system of medical care. We do what we can do to keep the body, you know, relatively healthy. But the problem comes is when we expect that it should actually stay that way and be that way. So we kind of move through life when we have these problems, and, you know, we try and find a cure. And, you know, we end up getting a treatment and maybe it doesn't work. We have an operation and it fails. Or the problem isn't what we thought it was, and it's going to take longer than we think, or it's not going to get better at all. This is my own situation. I was, you know, when I first, I just had the surgery 5 weeks ago, and before I went in, I thought, oh, I'd be up and moving in a couple of days, doing fine. That's what I was kind of led to believe. And so I submitted the body to a bit of Versed and morphine, went to sleep, woke up, and all of a sudden the doctor says, oh, well, it was quite a bit bigger than we thought it was going to be, so you're going to be, you know, in recovery for a bit longer. So just blissfully go to sleep and wake up and find out that I've been duped by this body. And it happens to, you know, to all of us in different ways. And we get kind of lulled in because then we get some sort of treatment that works, you know, and we think, ah, okay, now, you know, now I'll be able to really get down to practice. I'll be able to get back on the floor and sit, and my energy will return and everything will be fine, and that's that. So we willingly believe that it's, the problem is cured, and there's not going to be any more difficulty, home free. And maybe that lasts for a little while. And then something else, of course, happens. So it's not that we don't want to try and keep ourselves, keep these bodies going as best we can, but if there's any kind of expectation that then it's going to be all right. If only this were fixed, then it's going to be all right. If only I get this taken care of, then I'll be able to do what I need to do, and everything will be fine. If we have that kind of attitude, we're just going to set ourselves up for suffering the next time around. It's like, putting a Band-Aid on a gaping wound and thinking that it's going to heal it forever. Or plugging the hole in the Titanic with a piece of chewing gum. it's a desperate fantasy, really. We have a friend, Daniel Barnes. Everybody knows the name anyway, if you haven't met him, from the Barnes Room. He he was camping as a young man. He was out camping one evening and hiking in the mountains, and lay down in a field to sleep, and woke up a quadriplegic. He had been run over by a vehicle that was traveling through the night across this field, and woke up, found himself to be a quadriplegic. He wasn't expecting that when he went to sleep that night. And I was thinking about him just because, he always says, you know, sort of like, well, all the rest of us with quote-unquote able bodies refer to people in his situation as disabled. And he says that actually, you know, he and people that he knows who are quote-unquote disabled refer to us as TABS, temporarily able-bodied. So I think that's a really good reflection. Yeah. That's the best we can think of ourselves is a TAB. And even the body itself seems to reflect that, kind of buy into that notion of always wanting to move towards renewal and health and revitalization. And I've told this before, but it was such a strong image in my mind when Mary Curran, our next door neighbor, the former owner of Casa Serena, was diagnosed with her colon cancer, and was in the process of, you know, realizing that it was going to be the cause of her demise. It had spread to many other places in her body. But she had had a surgery in her colon to remove part of the diseased area, the cancer. And even though she was clearly in her last few weeks or so of life, I remember her lying there, and we were visiting, and her digestive system was shutting down. She wasn't taking very much in the way of nourishment, and starting to waste away, and other organ systems kind of following suit, the kidneys and circulatory system, even though she was getting fluids, IV, you know, they weren't doing what they were supposed to do and were collecting in, you know, various places, including the lungs, so she was having trouble breathing sometimes and swelling up here and there. And you know, you could see this body was packing it in. Yet, it was so noticeable, because there was one time when, I can't remember if it was Debbie or the nurse that came to visit, was changing the dressing on one of these surgical incisions that had been made for the operation. And the wound was healing, you know, it was getting better. And everybody was like, oh, that looks really good. You know, it's you know, that one, you know, that's not going to cause you any more problems. We won't have to change the bandage anymore. That's all healing up. You know, it just hit me as being so bizarre that here this body was, you know, completely packing in all of its major organ systems. She didn't have a lot longer to live, but still, the body was struggling to heal itself in this one little area, trying to mend this wound. And it struck me as so paradoxical. So the body itself is almost hardwired to support us in this kind of delusion of foreverness. And then when we turn our back, it proves otherwise. And it's the same with the other khandhas as well, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness. It's, you know, we have this expectation, this hope, this fantasy that as soon as we get rid of one unpleasant feeling, say, find something else to absorb into that's going to create some sukha-vedana, then things will be okay. And so we find something that does that, whether it's in the material realm or the mental realm, to give us a sense of a pleasant feeling. And we relax and we think, this is the way it's supposed to be. Like the pleasantness of a quote-unquote good meditation, how we rate our meditations as bad meditation or a good meditation. We come to expect that a good meditation is what we should have. And then feeling takes control and it pleasant turns to unpleasant. It constantly changes. Or our perceptions, how often do we find a perception that we've held with such faith and strength turn right around and assume the opposite stance? It's kind of the nature of perceptions. Sort of like a mirage, as I think the Buddha refers to it as a mirage. Just think of people, the perceptions we have of other people. Really, in our own experience, all that other people are really a perception in our minds. And how that can change. Somebody who we get along with really well and have a lot of good times with or happiness with, something changes and they do something that takes us back. And all of a sudden, they're a completely different person in our mind. The perception has changed. The faithful partner of 20 years, all of a sudden, you find out that they're shacking up with the secretary or inviting the mailman in for lunch. It's all of a sudden, whoa, what happened to that, wonderful person in my life who was always so warm and supportive and always there when I needed him or her? Perception has changed. Or more casually, just a someone that you get along with is having a bad day and says something sharp or angry, and all of a sudden they're an evil monster, at least for a period of time. So just when we think we've got it all settled with all the people around us and have the right mix and everybody's harmonizing, then something happens and it changes. Constantly changing, surprising us. Our moods, emotions, how much control, do we really have over those? We work with them and try and be more skillful, and we need to really work on cultivating these more wholesome states of mind. That is part of the path, but when we think that they should be some way and that they shouldn't be another way, then when something creeps up from that's usually out of the radar or based on past habits or past ways of reacting to things that come into our consciousness, then we miss the mark and we create another sankhara that's unpleasant or difficult or an old habit of negativity or aversion or whatever springs up just because we're not 100% mindful, we go into despair in reaction to that. It hasn't met our expectations once again, and we blame ourselves and compound it with that level of extra dukkha. Consciousness constantly changing. It's kind of the nature of consciousness is to weave this web of an illusion of continuity. Gives us a real, it's a this continuity through consciousness gives us this sense of solidity, a sense of identity. Consciousness constantly pulling data from the six senses, a rapid succession, finding a visual image, all of a sudden igniting visual consciousness, but how quickly boredom sets in with that particular visual object. It's interesting for a flash, and then the interest, the desire, the wish to experience that, to bring that into awareness, fades. Just as quickly, an interesting sound comes up, pleasant or unpleasant. It's interesting, captivates our attention. We pull that into the mind, and all of a sudden we're experiencing ear consciousness, or the same with all the other sense bases, feelings and tastes and tactile sensations and all the rest, the mind, the ideas of the mind, and consciousness constantly pulling one into awareness so that and then letting it go and taking another, so that we weave this sense of this is who I am. All of these moments put together create this sense of solidity, of continuity, like a rapidly changing movie being projected onto the screen. And we believe in it. So this is how the five khandhas, when they're affected by clinging, by desire, by confusion, delusion, that's how they operate, and how they kind of keep us feeling secure and entertained and feeling like this is who we are. And we are the sum of these aggregates, these experiences, and we perceive a solid sense of self in relation to one or all of them. And we just constantly renew that over and over again. And then we turn our backs and they betray us, disappoint. But it is kind of a paradox too, because when you look at the teachings, it looks like, how do you get out of all of this? The teachings point back to the five khandhas. They're not only our kind of murderer, but they're also the way out of this whole mess of suffering. There's another really nice story, very simple, but I always enjoyed the image of it, where a young deva of stunning beauty appears in front of the Buddha, illuminating, I think it's in Jeta's Grove, illuminating all of Jeta's Grove, of course. And, his name is Rohitasa, and he pays respects to the Buddha and asks him a question. He says, Bhante, is it possible by traveling that one can reach the end of the world, where there is no birth, no death, no birth, no aging, no death, no passing away and rebirth, where there's the end of suffering? And the Buddha says, no, Rohitasa, there is no there is no way by traveling that one can reach that end of the world, where there is no birth and aging and death and rebirth and end of suffering. Rohitasa says, oh, this is wonderful that you say that. He says, because in a past life, I was a seer, a kind of a sage, I think referred to as a skywalker, and I could, with one stride, I could stride across from one ocean to another ocean, and my speed was rapid, like that of a light, swift arrow soaring through the sky. And I had a lifespan of 100 years, and I spent that 100 years with my quick and long stride coursing through the cosmos, trying to find that end of the world where there is no birth and aging and death, and no passing away and rebirth, no suffering. And I died before I got to that place. And the Buddha responds, he says, yes, there is no way that by traveling you can reach the end of the world, the end of suffering. It's just in this fathom-long body where I tell you that there is the world, the origin of the world, the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. It's in this fathom-long body. So it's in these five khandhas, in the examination, the getting to know them, and the exploration, examination of what they really are and what they really aren't, that is the way leading to the end of suffering, the end of dukkha. So as Lungpa's been talking about the past couple of days, and at our Padimokkha today too, it's our practice is one of it's a brave kind of practice. It's we have to be willing to throw our whole life into it, our every bit of energy that we have. It's that kind of a, we have to be willing to make that kind of a commitment, because the habits are strong, and the tendency to want to find satisfaction through the experience of these five khandhas is very, very strong. And at the same time of having to be a full-on commitment, has to be done with an incredible amount of compassion and kindness and gentleness for the process. It's not something that can be forced on us, but has to be taken with a lot of care and attention and clarity. But we do have that ability. You know, the wonder of the teachings is that it is through this process of getting to know what it has been that has been fooling us all along, that we don't just disregard it, we don't just run away from it. We turn around and look at it. We kind of turn around and face the murderer, which is not something that's easy to do. But we do that. We turn around and we look at all of this that we've been investing in for so long, and we have to be willing to look at it with a fresh eye. We bring a lot of mindfulness and alertness to the process. That's the basis for the examination, is to be willing to see the truth, to look at it just as it is in its rawness. And at the same time, we are looking at that. We are willing to recondition our perceptions of the whole thing. We bring in cultivation of skillful mind states. They're part of the same process of perception. They're one of the khandhas. They're also subject to change, and deterioration in a way, but we use them in a skillful way. We bring up mindfulness and alertness and quietness of mind, the development of all the path factors, simplicity and renunciation and goodwill, kindness, gentleness, all of these things that I was talking about. And we take the tools of the aggregates that have been fooling us and turn them into instruments for a deeper understanding. And we see them, you know, in their true nature, and we get to know them. But we don't buy into any sense of permanence or solidity, or a sense that in and of themselves they will provide a refuge. But the promise is that if we pick them up skillfully and use the khandhas in that kind of very skillful way, that they will lead us to an understanding of really how they work, how they operate. And when we see that, we over and over and over again, the sense of disenchantment with finding any permanent sense of satisfaction, any permanent sense of identity, that fades. We become disenchanted with that process. And we learn to let go over and over and over again, and slowly not believe the false promises that we've believed in for so long. We've turned our back for so long, and now we have the opportunity to look at them squarely, look at them in the face, see them for what they really are, and use them for our own long-term happiness and ultimate liberation. As Ajahn Yanako said in a talk last month, and we have this good, great opportunity, I think that was the words, good, great opportunity to practice with this, these teachings that we're starting to look at with the exploration of the khandhas. There's a lot more that will be coming up in the next couple of weeks, and hopefully we can use them as a tool for fruitful contemplation. So I'll leave that for this evening.